He was there, off the coast of Australia, when his friend and longtime colleague was killed in a freakish accident which made global headlines. Today on Outlook, we speak to John Stainton, the manager and producer of Australia's crocodile hunter, Steve Irwin. This is the BBC. I'm Frederick Dove. Also on Outlook, how a small town became the eye donor capital of India because one man, after his death, wanted his eyes to be given to his partially blind grandson, a request which, as we'll hear, has made a positive difference to thousands of others. 2 weeks ago, the death of Australian wildlife expert Steve Irwin was flashed around the world, leaving his many fans and admirers stunned. He'd been struck in the chest by the toxic barb of a stingray while filming a documentary in shallow waters off the Australian coast. Steve Irwin gained global fame as the crocodile hunter through his animal documentaries, in which his trademark was to get very close to very dangerous animals on land and in water. Here's a clip of him at a zoo demonstrating a crocodile's predatory skills.
Their nostrils, their eyes and their ears. 3 points come up out of the water. Then when they think an animal gets close enough to the water's edge, they pull under. And then they use the thing that has kept them alive for 200 million years. They stalk their food. Have a look at the ripples on the surface. There isn't any. If I was a kangaroo, mate, this was dirty water. I'm as good as toast.
Steve Irwin, the showman and animal lover, in action with his favourite animal, the crocodile, many of which he kept at Australia Zoo, his own animal park. Following his death, tributes poured in. Hours after he died, callers gave their reaction to ABC radio presenter Ingrid Eust in Irwin's home state of Queensland.
Now, when people who are larger than life die, it's very hard to believe, isn't it? The death earlier today, around about midday, of wildlife researcher and entrepreneur Steve Irwin. Amanda joins me now, used to be a journalist on the sunny coast. Now, Amanda, you met Steve Irwin a number of times. Hello.
Yes, hello. Yeah, no, I was well over a decade ago now, but I first met Steve, I guess when he was well known overseas, but not so well known in Australia. And got sent out there to do some photos and to interview him, and he was just incredible. He didn't have an off switch. He was just amazing. And his enthusiasm for what he did was incredibly infectious, I have to say. I really clearly remember one thing. He was sort of showing me snakes and trying to make me touch these enormous snakes, though I had no intention of going anywhere near. But I said to him, "Do you want a cup of coffee?" And he said, "Do you think that I need caffeine?" And I just laughed because it was true. He didn't need any artificial high. He was high on life and high on what he was doing.
Can you imagine Steve Irwin drinking coffee, Amanda?
That's right. And that's what, it is a huge shock to hear that he's not here. He just seemed invincible to me.
Oh, dear, Tina has been holding on in Townsville. We thank you for being so patient. Tina, hello.
Hello.
Now, you've got a personal story. Did you meet Steve?
We didn't meet him, but before we were born, his father came over and pulled a big python out of our tree and that. We've all shared his passion for animals as we live on a station, and we've got every single video of Steve Irwin, and he's just been a hero, an icon for us.
Yeah. Look, Tina, it's really good to hear from you and also from someone at your age and stage and where you're living too. How did you feel when you found out the news?
When he died, I was just devastated. My icon dying, it was like the weirdest thing. It was like he didn't even die. It was like he's still alive, and you're just thinking, does that really happen?
Yeah.
And, it was such a shame for he's a hero for nearly all Australians, and to see him die, that was, really terrible.
Mm.
We're just still so upset, but Steve's always going to be in our hearts, and as long as we always acknowledge what he's done, we'll all be happy.
In Australia, Sydney Morning Herald newspaper, Steve Irwin was described as, quote, a simple hero for a complicated age. This Wednesday, there's to be a public memorial service for him. Though there had been suggestions of a state funeral, his wife Terry and his family opted instead for a private funeral. It took place a few days ago, and among those invited was John Stainton, Steve Irwin's longtime associate and friend. Does he agree that a private event had been more appropriate?
Definitely. As his dad said the other day, he was just a very ordinary bloke. And I think Steve would not have wanted to have a state funeral whatsoever. I think just having a family affair was exactly where his head would have been at. So, yeah, that's what happened. It was only just a quiet ceremony with all his family and just a handful of very, very close friends, and a very simple, simple service.
What was the atmosphere? Because, you know, on the one hand, obviously it was a tragically early death. On the other hand, he had achieved a lot, made obviously a lot of friends. He had a lot of admirers and fans. So, you know, for this private service, what was the mood?
Sad. I think the fact that Steve died so quickly and unexpectedly was a shock to everybody. I think, you know, his family find it very hard to come to terms with it, because he was 44 years old and had everything to live for, and just to be plucked off the earth at that time of life was just the biggest shock, because no one had expected it. He hadn't, you know, if he'd been sick or, you know, been doing anything dangerously bad at that point, you know, we became so close to, you know, in dangerous situations all over the years that were a lot more critical than where we were and what we were doing. I think it would have been more acceptable, but I think the fact that it was just on the reef, and, you know, it was swimming around over the top of a stingray, and it was only in about, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet of water. It wasn't very deep. And for that to happen, I think, is what really stung the family as well.
How far away were you at the time? You were there as well, weren't you?
I was on the boat. I was on Croc 1, which is Steve's research vessel. He'd gone off with the crew to film in the just on the reef, which was not far away from where the boat was, obviously. But probably, I don't know, he'd be 400 or 500 yards away. He wasn't a long way away.
And when did you realise that something had happened? Were you able to watch the pictures as they were being filmed, or did?
No, I didn't. It wasn't that sort of underwater thing. But it's a blur. That whole episode was a blur. But I can remember there was some sort of urgency, a medevac, call for a medevac on the radio, and that somebody had been hurt. I didn't hear that it was Steve until they got to the back of the boat, when I saw it was him. That was the shock of my life then.
And there was nothing that could be done for him at this point?
Oh, I don't think so. I think it was just so, I think it was, you know, reasonably instantaneously. I don't think he would have really had time to suffer that much at all. It just wasn't, you know, it was just a wound that had probably hit his heart, I think.
Now, you'd known him for many, many years. How did you first meet?
I have a production company that made commercials and documentaries and television shows, and I met Steve where he brought a lizard to the set for a commercial one day, and that was when I first met him. And then, but I didn't get to the zoo until 1990, and that was when I got on his turf, on his territory. I realized what an amazing man he was. He was just enthusiastic, full of life, and I could see there was something there that, you know, had a possibility. And he showed me all these tapes. He gave me all these videotapes that he'd shot of him catching crocs in the wilds of North Queensland over the years. They're all shot on VHS, on a little home video camera he had. And he used to put the camera in a tree or on the back of a truck, and he'd film himself so that, you know, there might be a take that would run 20 minutes or half an hour. But he'd keep running up to the camera, and he'd zoom it in and zoom it out again, and he'd talk to the camera. And I looked at one tape one night. It was 3 hours long, and I just was amazed at what I saw. I thought he was so good, and what he was doing was just beyond belief, with catching a croc single-handedly, like a 12-foot croc in a net, and getting it out of the net and putting it into a box without getting bitten, and talking to the camera the whole time, telling the camera what was happening. And I just saw he had that gift way before I met him. He'd been shooting those tapes for a long time, late 80s.
Why would he have been doing that? I mean, was he rehearsing
because
for future stardom? Or just because...
No. And no, all his mates didn't believe him. You know, he'd go off into the bush for 3 months at a time on his own, catching crocodiles, road crocodiles, for relocation under the government program. And he'd come back and tell all these stories, and no one would believe him. That was the problem. So his father bought him a camera and gave it to him. And he used to take this camera, and he'd come home, and he'd have home movie nights and show all his friends what he'd been doing.
millions around the world saw him, you know, get so close to crocodiles, to other animals as well. And there were those who questioned whether he really needed to get this close. But from what you're saying, he was doing that from way back, even before, you know, I mean, with his own camera, but even without cameras, he was doing this.
Yeah, exactly. His father was catching crocodiles when he was just a boy. I think Steve jumped on his first crocodile when he was 9 years old.
Do you feel he was always completely in control?
Yep, always. He knew how far the crew could come. He knew how far he could go. He had a great sense of just... He used to be able to say to the cameraman, okay, you can come in, you can come in, come in, stop. That's as far as you can go, no further. Stay there, I will work the snake to that camera position. And he did. He could always keep the cameraman totally in safety every time. But he probably came close a number of times to getting a snake bite or a snake hit, but he never did. He was always just that quick, you know, to get away.
Some people have criticized him for obviously getting the animals to react. What was his aim in doing that?
Well, to stand out on television, you have to be a lot brasher and a lot brighter and bigger than the competition. The thing was that Steve always believed that if he could touch an animal on television, he could touch somebody's heart in the living room. He used to say that all the time. I mean, John, every time I touch an animal, I know I'm touching somebody's heart that's watching the show, because I'm giving the animal a personality, which most people hate snakes, hate crocodiles. In Australia and America, they drive, run over them to kill them. And the biggest thing that we had over the years, the biggest credit we ever had, was that we used to get lots and lots, hundreds, thousands of emails of people saying, you know, we used to hit snakes on the road to kill them. Now, since we've been watching your show, we've learnt, you know, that that's the wrong thing to do. And now we either go around them or we stop and take them off the road. I always used to think, God, I hope it wasn't a venomous snake that they were taking off the road. But we did make a mark.
What would be your favourite memory of Steve Irwin?
Do you know, I've got a million. I just think that he was just an amazing man that I had a great friendship with, that I feel very sad that I've lost him. And I don't know whether he's gone. I every day I go through my work, but I always feel that his hand's on my shoulder. I just feel that he's still there guiding me. And just a small story, with all the crocs in the zoo that he had, that he'd caught nearly all of them. And so they were, probably had a grudge against him, and they all knew his voice. So you had, you know, 14, 15 foot crocs in the zoo, that if he came anywhere near their enclosure and they heard his voice, they'd go into attack mode. You know, they'd all get really ready to go into attack mode, because they thought he was going to come into the enclosure. Anyone else, the normal, you know, croc handling boys that would go in and feed them, or Terry, who would go into the enclosure, they'd just lay there in the sun, as crocs do, to get, you know, their body warmed up. But if they heard Steve's voice, it was a totally different reaction. They'd go into the water and sit under the water waiting for, thinking that he'd come in and they could attack. And when we were filming anything we wanted to film in the zoo, we'd have to leave Steve way out, away from the enclosures, until we'd set up and got everything ready, and then we'd get him in, because they'd go into alert. It was really, it's funny how, you know, animals that you think don't have much intelligence have an incredible amount of intelligence. And Steve's aura, it was almost like he was threatening them with their sort of the male dominance thing. Because they're always, you know, males and very territorial, and it was like, you know, Steve's voice, they knew that he was coming, so it was like this male dominance, you got to get out of my territory or I'm going to kill you.
Sounds like they didn't like him, but did he like them?
He loved them. For a day, there was one occasion a couple of years ago, Mary, which was his oldest crocodile in the zoo, she was a matriarch of the zoo, she was about 120 years old, which is very old for a croc. I mean, they go to probably 80 or 100. Very few of them go past that, but this one was 120 that they knew. And she just was dead one morning in her enclosure in the water. She lived with a big male called Agro, who was a really, you know, the worst adversary for Steve. And the keepers, one of the keepers found her kind of just floating in the water in the enclosure, and ran and got Steve. And he came down and he spent hours. He actually went into the water, which I don't know how Agro didn't come and kill him. He went into the water and he just hugged her and cried and cried and cried for the whole, for like half a day, and that he wouldn't let her go. And then he buried her in the zoo and he cried like a baby. And the fact that crocodile, the male crocodile, never came near him. And it was, they never sighted the other croc, which could have, if normally if he'd have been in the water, that croc would have taken Steve out there and then. But Steve was so over emotional about Mary dying, he didn't care. But Agro gave him that space. So, you know, there is something with crocodiles that you know, we don't give them credit for. And Steve's emotion for, I have seen Steve give a crocodile that was accidentally, nothing to do with him, but was accidentally hurt and looked like it was dead. I saw Steve give it mouth-to-mouth resuscitation for over an hour and do CPR on its heart, a 12-foot croc, to bring it back to life. He was a very powerful force. He had a great aura around him.
TV producer John Stainton remembering his friend Steve Owen. Coming up later, we speak to friends of Ricky Rodriguez, a young man who may one day have become leader of a religious movement known as the Family International. Instead, traumatized by witnessing what's alleged to have been sexual and physical abuse of young members, he killed a former member of the group before killing himself. You're listening to Outlook from the BBC World Service. Can a politician really lead by personal example and make the world a better place? Ask the residents of Neemuch and they might well say yes. Neemuch is a town in the Indian state of Madhya Pradesh and known as the eye donor capital of India. This started when a local politician declared that after his death, he wanted to donate one of his eyes to his grandson, who was blind in one eye. This inspired others in Neemuch to express their willingness to be eye donors after their death. And thanks to that, as Faisal Muhammad Ali now reports, more than 3,000 people across India have since received eye transplants.
The idea of eye donation in Neemuch began some 30 years ago, thanks to one man. A local politician, Shamshu Garg, pledged his eyes for the benefit of his grandson, who had only one eye. The grandson, Madhu Garg, told me what happened.
I remember that my grandfather was very loving to me, very, very loving to me. Aur kafi early age mein wo chale bhi gaye.
We never talked about my eyes or the idea of an eye donation when my grandfather was alive. I don't think anyone even knew about eye donation at the time. I lost the sight in one eye at a very young age. My friends used to tease me about it. My grandfather died young, and I think he thought, I have two perfectly good eyes, and my grandson needs one. It didn't work out, though. The doctor said that the nerves in my eyes had died, so a transplant would not work. I think he would have donated his eyes to anyone. His idea was that this is a part of my body that can be of use to somebody else after my death, so someone should use my eyes when I'm gone.
30 years on, a grandfather's love for his grandson has grown into a social movement with a number of organizations and locals' involvement. Mohanlal Garg is one of them. He said how they began the campaign and encouraged people to donate their eyes.
It began with Shamshuk Garg donating eyes to his grandson. Then we were able to convince his sister's family to do the same. The third eye donation in the town was that of a prominent politician. It convinced people that there wasn't a problem with donating eyes. We also did a door-to-door campaign, telling people why it was a good idea to donate their eyes after death.
Earlier notorious for the cultivation and smuggling of poppies, the townspeople now talk proudly of Neemuch's newfound social cause. Mohan Vardhani is a well-known physician in the town.
Neemuch is top in the field of eye donation. It's really wonderful. Eyes are of no use after death. This work should be highlighted. I donated the eyes of my 20-year-old daughter, Reshmi. All the members of my family have made a declaration that they want to donate their eyes after their deaths.
Today, this town of 100,000 people gets almost 1,000 eye donation pledges every year. S.C. Jacob, A surgeon is the head of an eye specialty hospital in the town.
We used to send the corneas to Mumbai or other cities for transplants. Then a hospital was set up here, which made it much easier. If you take the number of eye donors compared to the population of the town, it makes Neemuch the highest eye donor town in the country.
As Mohan explains, before the special eye hospital was set up, getting the eyes to the people who needed them was never easy.
We had to plead with the doctors for them to preserve the eyes with an injection. It's very important. And then we used to arrange for vacuum flasks to transport the eyes to other cities around the country. Most of the time, the bus drivers would carry the flasks free of charge, but some of them used to ask for money. Now doctors are available here in the hospital. It's made things much easier.
This small town has become the hub of eye surgery. As I walk through the hospital, I meet a middle-aged woman who has come here from the nearby town. An eye transplant has changed the life of Asha, a young fruit seller.
My eyesight was really bad. I had treatment for 2 years. Then the doctors called me and I came here. And I got a transplant and now I can see. Before I couldn't work at all, but now I can.
But it's not just about helping others to be able to see. Some people here in Neemuch like the idea of organ donation because it gives them the feeling that part of their loved ones live on. The Tootla brothers donated the eyes of both their parents.
We donated the eyes of my father initially. Then my mother became interested and said she wanted to do the same. So we donated her eyes after her death too. It is really a good feeling to know a loved one is living on, even if only through one part of his body.
And that report from Neemuch in Madhya Pradesh in India was by Faisal Muhammad Ali. A reminder of our competition, which is closing very soon. What's been your most memorable journey? Send us your story in no more than about 200 words, and you could win one of 3 digital cameras we're offering as prizes in the competition. Entries must reach us by September 22nd. That's Friday at the end of this week. You can email them to outlook@bbc.co.uk. And if you're quick, you can still send them by post to Outlook, BBC World Service, Bush House, London.
BBC.
They drew 6 squares on my back, and they took a roll of Scotch tape, stuck it on, and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off my back, and put the bubble bath directly on the raw area.
There are 6 billion people with a story to tell. There's one place to tell the story.
He sprayed this stuff on my back. The stuff was so toxic that I could taste it in my mouth.
Share what matters to you with the rest of the world.
So they told me I could go back to the block. I went back to my housing area. Stepped into my cell and passed out on the floor.
Go to the Outlook website for details of how to record your story and to listen to some of the other 6 billion people's personal experiences. The Outlook website at bbcworldservice.com/outlook.
Over to You is our new weekend program that gives you the chance to let us know what you think about our programs. Sundays at 12:40 Central European Time on the BBC World Service.
Coming up on Outlook after the news, allegations of institutionalized sexual abuse of children and young people. We hear from former members of a controversial religious movement once called the Children of God. We'll also put the allegations to a spokeswoman for the group.
But first, this news.
BBC World News, I'm Dee Sebastian. The French President Jacques Chirac has spoken out against referring Iran to the United Nations Security Council over its nuclear program. With the Security Council due to meet soon to consider sanctions, Mr. Chirac said negotiations were the only way to find a solution. He said both sides should make concessions, suggesting Iran could renounce uranium enrichment once negotiations were underway and not as a precondition for talks. Meanwhile, the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, received support for his country's stand on the nuclear issue during a visit to Venezuela. The Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, said it was the United States and its allies whose nuclear weapons were a threat, and they should set an example by destroying their own arsenals instead of harassing Iran. Afghan officials say a suicide bomber has blown himself up among a group of Canadian soldiers and Afghan children in the southern province of Kandahar, causing a number of casualties. Reports say the soldiers were giving out small gifts to the children in the Panjwayi district when the bomber attacked. Maoist rebel leaders in Nepal have expressed optimism after a meeting with the Prime Minister, Girija Prasad Koirala, saying the atmosphere of mutual suspicion between the two sides has been lifted. The government in Sri Lanka says the bodies of 11 Muslim men have been found in a remote jungle area in the east. It said they'd been shot and hacked to death. The Malaysian foreign minister, whose country chairs the Organization of the Islamic Conference, has called on Pope Benedict to issue a full retraction of a speech last week in which he quoted a medieval text criticizing Islam. The centre-right coalition that won Sweden's general election on Sunday has begun talks to form a new government to take over from the Social Democrats, who've been in power for the past 12 years. And the first female space tourist has taken off from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. BBC News.
This is Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Frederick Dove. If you have any comments on anything in the programme, do remember we'd like you to email us, outlook@bbc.co.uk. Sarah and Don are young Americans who say they've struggled to adjust to normal life after leaving a religious group once known as the Children of God and now called the Family International. It grew out of the California hippie movement in the 1960s and was started by David Brandt Berg. Though he died in 1994, the group still has thousands of members on several continents. However, it's been dogged by controversy and allegations of institutionalized sexual abuse. In January last year, 29-year-old Ricky Rodriguez, once seen as David Berg's chosen successor, killed himself after murdering Angela Smith. She too had been a member of the family. A TV documentary about Ricky Rodriguez has just been shown on British television. We'll hear an extract and we'll meet Sarah and Don shortly. First, Rick Ross, who's worked with former members and their families, told me more about this movement and its mission.
Well, essentially its mission was to evangelize the world and to share the gospel with as many people as possible, bringing them to what they would see as salvation.
Now, David Berg was a man of much charisma. I mean, he became known later among the group as Moses David. He communicated with his followers by so-called Mo letters. I mean, how charismatic was he? Was he really pivotal to the growth of this group?
Well, the group has often been called a cult, and perhaps the most salient feature of a group that bears that label would be that it's personality driven. And certainly Berg's followers saw him as a defining element of their organization. He was a prophet, perhaps likened to an apostle, that through his vision, through his personality, he really defined what the Children of God were, now known as the family.
The group became known for sex being sort of very important to its activities, sex among the members. New members were sometimes recruited through a tactic of flirty fishing. But when did allegations surface of child abuse?
Well, the allegations regarding child abuse really surfaced as a direct result of complaints from families and from former members. This would have become very widely known during the 80s. And of course, the group distributed literature that literally depicted children being sexualized and some of its more radical teachings. Perhaps the family that was most widely known to be associated with Berg was the Phoenix family, which included the actor River Phoenix and his brother Joaquin Phoenix. Eventually, River Phoenix, like many former members, children that had grown up in the Children of God, became involved in drugs and died at the age of 26. But many, many of these children who left the group have struggled after leaving.
One of the other young members within the group at one point was Ricky Rodriguez. What was the connection between Ricky Rodriguez and David Berg?
Well, the connection was that Karen Zerbe, now who is the leader of the group, known as Karen Berg, Rodriguez was her child, and he was raised as a member of the immediate family of Berg, and he, like all the children in the group, and you mentioned it, I think, aptly when you said institutionalized sexual abuse, which means essentially that the group taught sexual abuse of children as an article of faith. And Rodriguez did not escape that. He, at a very early age, was molested. Even though he was designated not only as a potential successor, but as a messianic figure widely recognized by the group.
Well, a documentary about the events leading up to Ricky Rodriguez's death has just been shown on Britain's Channel 4 TV network. Included in the program were these extracts from the suicide note Ricky Rodriguez recorded on video before taking his life.
Well, hey everyone, this is Rick, and I'm making this video. I want there to be some record, just who I was, really. So that I don't blow my nose off instead of my head. How can you do that to kids? How can you do that to kids in secret? I can only imagine what my sister goes through. She has nightmares about, you know, being dragged out of bed in the middle of the night to go have sex with Berg. You know, anger does not begin to describe how I feel about these people and what they've done. But yeah, I mean, I guess I said all I can say, and what can I say, you know? I would have a peaceful, happy life. I tried. I did. Maybe I didn't try hard enough. Gave it what I could, you know. I did.
Extracts from the documentary Cult Killer, The Ricky Rodriguez Story, a WAG TV production for Channel 4. Sarah Martin and Don Irwin both spent their childhood growing up as junior members of the family and left after becoming disillusioned. Both had spent time with Ricky Rodriguez in Southern California before he murdered Angela Smith and killed himself. Sarah Martin told me how she'd got to know Ricky Rodriguez.
I've known him for a few years, although I feel I know him better just because we basically grew up with him. His life was publicized within our group. He started talking to me when my brother committed suicide a couple of years ago. And he was quite a big help to me. He would chat with me online to late hours in the night and, you know, just email back and forth as friends, and invited him out here a couple of times. And then eventually he moved out here, and that's how I became friends with him.
How much did this idea that he was the heir apparent of the family of the Children of God, how much did that weigh on his shoulders? Was that something that was integrally bound up with his life?
I think it's something that was promoted by Berg in his writings from the time he was very young, and it was a huge responsibility. He could never go and hang out and just sort of be one of the guys, because his mother would always require the cult members to send her reports so that she could monitor what influence or impact he was having on cult members. And that was something that he really rebelled against, because he didn't want to be anyone else's person. He wanted to be his own man. And from the very first time that I started talking with him in 2000, his, you know, hatred and abhorrence of his mother's and Berg's legacy was very, very apparent.
He did talk about suicide a lot, but at the same time, he did want to do something to help his peers. I don't think, you know, any of us realized the extent that he would go to do that. But one of the main things that bothered him was actually what happened to Don's sister, who was living with him at the time.
To Mary Berg, who was actually Berg's granddaughter. She's my sister on my mother's side. Her father, Paul Berg, committed suicide in 1973, and she later was, you know, sexually molested, assaulted, raped by Rick's, you know, father, if you will, David Brandt Berg, the leader of the cult. And then when she began to rebel, when she was 14, 15, they began to administer this horrific corporal punishment. They would tie her to beds. They would, you know, beat her for hours as sort of exorcisms. And Rick was privy to that. You know, he saw that. And she would ask him for help, but there was nothing that he could do because he was, you know, a 10, 11-year-old boy. And he was, you know, freaked out that if he would do anything, then what was happening to her would happen to him.
Because of your parents being members of the Children of God, of the family, you were also on the inside. How would you sum up what this organization stood for, what its central beliefs were?
There were some central beliefs, like you had to believe that Berg was a prophet. You had to believe that, you know, we're living in the end time and Jesus was going to come back anytime. But then it was this sexual doctrine, this bizarre sexual doctrine that extended to children, was introduced and was something that Berg talked about almost incessantly. And a lot of the whole doctrine was focused around this sort of communal living, but also very isolationist sort of communal living. Like when I left, I had no education, I had no money, I had no, you know, formal work experience. And I think that sense of abandonment has been really, really hurtful to a lot of survivors. And we see that reflected in the very, very high rates of suicide, the very high rates of substance abuse amongst survivors. In many cases, we're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. We're suffering from all of the symptoms associated with systematic abuse. And we don't have adequate support to help us in this transitional period. And that's something that, as a group of survivors, we need help, because we can't continue to suffer the losses that we have on a year-to-year basis to suicide, to a self-destructive behavior, because it's horrific by any standards.
One thing that really never changed is they've always abided by the one law, the law of love. It's still all based on that one law, love, and they basically use it to do whatever they want to do. I remember going to this one home where they told us that we had to wear sarongs around our waist, which meant we had to be topless. And I was only like 11 or 12 years old. And I remember being very uncomfortable with that and, you know, trying to cover my breasts with my hair so that it wouldn't be so, you know, obvious. And I got in trouble for that. They pulled my hair back and, you know, basically they told me that, you know, you shouldn't be ashamed of your body. God, I mean, you grew up with that basically as normal. It was normal to be naked. It was normal to see your parents having sex in the next bed. I mean, you never really thought much of it. The only thing you thought was if it made you uncomfortable, but you never thought it was wrong. And when the letters came out about his sister and her problems and how to handle rebellion, they started isolating the children that were rebellious, that had questions about the doctrines. And they took us away from our parents. They took me and my brother away and sent us to this, what they called a Victor program. And I was there for about 2 years in Japan and then another year and a half in Italy. And my parents didn't know what was going on to us there, because they told us they were sending us away for retraining, you know, Christian beliefs, yada, yada, yada. When really it was just brainwashing, torture.
Corporal punishment, manual labor. It was false imprisonment, the whole...
And being a long way away from your parents at times.
And we couldn't write our parents to tell them what was happening, because they would read all of our letters. And if we said anything negative in those letters, they would make us rewrite it.
In my case, we were living fairly happily as a family unit until I was about 8 years old. And that's when, you know, Berg said that he wanted his granddaughter, that was my sister, to go and record music at this music studio. And they told us it was going to be for 3 months. Well, she never came back. I didn't see her again for, well, 13 years, you know. You know, my father was asked to go and work on this project. And again, they didn't let him come back. And then finally, when my mom left the cult in 1985, I sort of became an orphan in the group, if you will, at about 10 years of age. And, you know, from that time until I was 21, I basically, you know, lived without my biological parents.
At what point in your own life did you decide it was time to leave? And when you started thinking along those lines, how difficult was it to do so?
Well, for me, it was very difficult because I was at that Victor program. And when I had asked them if I could leave, I was about 15, I think, at this time. Basically, I was told no. In fact, because of voicing those doubts, I was taken out and isolated, put on a fast and prayer session where I had to listen to headphones 24 hours a day, except when they had someone reading to me. I wasn't allowed to have any food other than liquids, you know, soup or something that they blended. And that was for about 2 weeks. So I wasn't able to leave until I was 18 years old. And the day
when you were 18, were you then able to just walk out the door?
Well, at that point, I was back with my parents. And so I was able to call my grandmother and ask her for help. So she took me in when I first left. Otherwise, I don't even know if I would have been able to leave because I had nowhere to go. And I had no knowledge of how to live in the outside world. I hadn't even used a phone until I was 18 years old. There are no phones in the place. There's nowhere to call 911. But beyond that, you know, one of the reasons that I speak about this is because of what happened to Ricky and other children who have left. I don't want it to get to that point where it got with Ricky, because they don't have anywhere to go, and it's very hard for them to adjust to the outside world.
Absolutely.
And they have no help. And things need to change in our court system because, you know, we have tried for years to bring our abusers to justice, and it's very difficult because we were very young when all this happened, and it happened in other countries. And due to the statute of limitations here in the U.S., you can no longer prosecute them for their crimes, no matter how horrific they were.
Because it's too long ago.
Because it's too long ago. And I think that's why Ricky felt so stuck, and because he felt like the system has failed us. And this is important, that abused children do not feel like the system fails them, because then they have nothing to do and they have to live with this. And that's why I believe it was frustrating for Rick, and possibly why, you know, he turned to do what he had to do. He felt there was no other options.
Don, let me ask you, you said your mom left the organization in 1985. Your father was still a member.
That's
you
right.
Left about 9 years ago. How difficult was it for you to do so?
Well, I did the same thing as what Sarah did. When I was about 14, I said, you know what, I was just looking around and there was just too many inconsistencies. I knew that this was wrong. I knew that there was abuse happening. I wanted to leave. I wanted to get an education. I wanted to have a normal life. I wanted to, you know, my little fantasy was to be a pilot. So I told him when I was 14, hey, I don't believe in this. I'd like to leave. I want to go to university and I want to have a normal life. And they did exactly the same thing to me as what they did to Sarah. They immediately took me, you know, away from the rest of the group. They put me into isolation. They sent me from my country where I was living in Indonesia at the time to Thailand. And, you know, they had control of my passport. I couldn't go to the consulate if I wanted to or ask for help. I didn't have any idea how that was done. I grew up in this isolationist environment. And, you know, so I just evaluated the situation and I was like, you know what, I've got no options. So I'm just going to, you know, toe the party line and just buckle down and try to, you know, keep myself out of the line of fire. And what I ended up doing is I ended up going to their main publications unit where I thought, okay, let me give this one more go. Maybe these were just bad people at the lower levels and, you know, the top really didn't intend for any of these horrible things to happen. I mean, they kept us in the dark a lot, and deception was institutionalized. So I went to their main, you know, sort of administrative headquarters, if you will, and I worked, you know, more closely with the top leadership. And I had been there for about 15 minutes and I realized, oh my God, every allegation, every thing that I've heard bad about these people, it's all true. And I just realized I really had to leave. And I was scared. And around about that time, thankfully, my mother had been trying to write me that whole time, and I was able to, they finally let me go and visit her. So I visited her for 10 days, and then I went back to the Colts unit, and I told them that, you know, I was going to leave. And at that point, they took me again out of that house, put me in isolation for 3 months where they kind of tried to figure out what they were going to do with me. Finally, they just said, well, go and live with your estranged mother in San Diego. And so I did that and, you know, went and started trying to put my life together.
And have you been able to retain links with your father?
You know what? Up until the whole tragedy with Ricky, I did maintain links with him, and he actually came out to my graduation when I graduated from university. But when this whole thing with Ricky came, and I had been collecting information on the activity of these criminals for a long time, and I sat down with my dad and I said, look, maybe you were young when you joined this group. Maybe you didn't know what it was about. Maybe you got caught up in something because, you know, you had some deficiency in your own past. But now this is what has come out. This is the truth. This is not a lie. This is not an allegation. This is what happened. And it's so incredibly hurtful of you to continue to support these perpetrators by your membership, by your money, by all of these things. And you need to do something. You need to take a stand. That was last year, and I haven't heard from him for about 16, 17 months.
No
contact at all. He used to sometimes call, send me an email. Once this thing happened, and I told him, I said, look, you know, I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't want, you know, family homes now to get raided and children to be traumatized, but I do want justice. And I'm going to say something in terms of making some sense of why somebody would be so damaged that they would go to the lengths that Ricky went to in order to pursue justice. There's a reason. These things don't just happen. You know, the cult's been giving out this canned statement, journalists should take care not to casually dismiss, you know, whatever it is that they're writing, of a disturbed young man, I think is what they're using. And you know what? He was disturbed. But children don't come into the world disturbed like that. They become disturbed because of what you did to them.
You're looking for justice, but you've got things going back a long way, as you say, possibly exceeding the statute of limitations. Is justice realistic, do you think, as far as you see it?
I think that we have to be idealistic in this situation. We have to have some type of hope, because this was a Holocaust of what happened to us. It was a silent Holocaust, and we're paying the price every day with suicides, with drug overdoses, with you know, people who have no education, who are just thrown out into the world, no training.
The people who did these things need to be removed from their positions of leadership, and their victims need to have the opportunity to bring them to court, because that's the thing. They don't report to anyone. They don't report to any law but themselves.
It's so sad, because even in their canned statements that they give to the press, they say, yes, there was some instances of abuse, and, you know, it's since become an excommunicable offense. What I've never heard media people ask is, oh, so you admit that there were these instances of abuse. Well, what have you done about them? Have you done anything to provide any type of services to the victims, psychological services, medical services? I mean, there's one girl who can't have children because she was raped when she was 12 years old. And so they acknowledge that these things happen. You know, there were instances of abuse. Really? Did you turn the people over to the police? There's no sense of moral outrage. They're more concerned with protecting their own behinds, if you will, than protecting children. So we don't have an ideological agenda to dismantle the group. There's people who are doing good things, more power to them, but they have to be accountable. This secret society type of thing where everyone covers for themselves, that's got to stop.
Don Irwin and Sarah Martin, who both decided to leave the Family International. You're listening to Outlook from the BBC World Service. Joining us now from California is Claire Borowick from the Public Affairs Desk for the Family International. Claire, do you accept that there have been cases of child abuse within the Family International?
I think we've acknowledged on several occasions that in a past era, there had occurred some cases. However, we definitely do not accept the picture being portrayed here of institutionalized abuse, of cover-ups and hiding. The family was subjected to raids in several countries around the world, and children were evaluated, examined, over 700 children, and never a single case of abuse emerged in all those children. I just don't buy this story that's being peddled here.
As you say, there have been a few cases. You accept that. Now, if there have been a few cases, what happened to the people involved in those found guilty within the organization of having done things they shouldn't have? Were they expelled? Were they handed to the police?
You have to understand how this historically came about, Fred. The family grew out of the hippie movement, and Father David did preach a liberal doctrine regarding sexuality, and he failed to put in strong safeguards for the protection of minors, and this was his responsibility. In the late 80s, in 1986 actually, when it came to the ears of leadership that some young people were feeling that they were being subjected to unwanted advances and they were unhappy with this, immediate action was taken. Absolutely banned any kind of interaction with any minors. And in 1988, it was announced as an excommunicable offense. This policy hasn't changed in the last nearly 20 years. So I would say that our church took immediate and stringent action.
And since those safeguards were brought in that you describe, has anyone been expelled? Has anyone had to justify what happened before then?
It depends on if people report. Again, Sarah and Don are presenting very sweeping allegations of suicides and drugs, but actually we have 32,000 former members, and most of them have adapted fairly well and are doing well, and I don't believe that the rate of suicides is any higher than that of society at large.
You say that David Berg didn't put in certain safeguards, which were then put in. Is that saying that some of the things he did were not, shall we say, up to scratch, were wrong?
Absolutely. And Karen Zerbe made a public acknowledgement of this before a British judge, Lord Justice Ward, and apologized. And his comments were that it was a very fulsome apology. And the family has done everything possible to implement stringent safeguards, to protect children. And not only that, for example, Don and Sarah have talked about children in the family not receiving an education. Well, I find that prejudicial. Our children are homeschooled. Learning 3 or 4 languages is an education. Participating in humanitarian efforts such as tsunami relief, helping victims in Africa, building orphanages, schools, working with the deaf, that is an education. That is training.
You mentioned Karen Zerbe, or Karen Berger, she's also known. Now, she's in charge now, as you say. Does that imply, though, that essentially, although some things have changed, and as you say, you acknowledge that some of the things David Berg did were not right, but essentially the organization remains the same as it was, shall we say, during the early 70s?
Well, what remains the same is that the family is devoted to carrying the message of God's love and to attending to the needs of the poor. That has remained unchanged. However, the family of the 70s and the family of today are very different. Now we have our second generation, the peers of Don and Sarah, who are themselves parents, and half the young people born in the family are currently members and have a very different take on this entire issue.
And I was talking to Claire Borowick from the Public Affairs Desk for the Family International, formerly known as the Children of God. My thanks also to former members Sarah Martin and Don Irwin, and to Rick Ross, from whom we heard earlier. Any thoughts or comments, do email outlook@bbc.co.uk. The programme's back, same time tomorrow. Do join us then.
There is a number so big that you can't count up to it. So big that it isn't actually a number at all. It's just a concept. So really, it doesn't exist. Everything is nothing. Think about it. Lots of other people have. A Brief History of Infinity starts Wednesday at 10, 13 and 21 Central European Time on the BBC World Service.
If you're a fan of BBC documentaries, then make sure you spend some time browsing our archive of recent programmes. Just go to bbcworldservice.com and click Documentary Archive.
This is the BBC in Kinshasa.
Bucharest.
Nairobi.
Taipei.
Los Angeles.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.